Hello, everybody. Glad you could all make this. We are here today, and hopefully you're all looking forward to a talk by Paul, Catherine, and Sean on the use and communication of enterprise risk management, a GI perspective. If you're not, then you're probably in the wrong room. Paul Goswami, has been working in the general insurance industry for the last 15 years. He joined Deloitte in November last year to strengthen its growing general insurance practice. Prior to joining Deloitte, Paul was Guy Carpenter's Instrat practice leader for Australia and New Zealand, and he provided pricing and capital advice to a number of organisations. He's worked on a wide variety of actuarial tasks since moving to Australia in 2002. Historically, he specialised in reinsurance underwriting and pricing in the London market, where he held the role of chief pricing actuary at the Faraday Syndicate before moving to Sydney. A key aspect of Paul's current role is in the development of enterprise risk management, the frameworks and concise communication of its merits, particularly to the wider business community. Catherine has over 10 years' experience in the general health and life insurance industries. She joined Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants General Insurance Practice in April last year. Since then, she's been involved in a number of valuation and audit assignments. Prior to joining Deloitte, Catherine was the company actuary at Manchester Unity, where she was responsible for the preparation of annual budgets and financial forecasts and determining insurance liabilities, the pricing and design of new products, and monitoring solvency and capital adequacy position. Sean is a last-minute add-in, and he's a non-actuary, so we're particularly interested in his input to this. He's also at Deloitte and is in risk consulting, and he'll be talking in particular about the operational and strategic risk in practice. Without further ado, I'll hand over to them.
Good afternoon, everyone. What we're going to do today is give you an overview of enterprise risk management. We will also provide you with an approach to establish an ERM framework. And we will also look at some practical ways of dealing with operational and strategic risk. The interesting thing about this picture is that if I would have shown that to you about 12 months ago, you would have thought that it was some sort of comical exaggeration. Well, now it's actually comical reality, and it's forcing us to have a very good look at ERM. I couldn't really start a conversation on ERM without giving a definition. That's the casualty definition. There are a few other definitions around, but that's my favourite one. And what it does is actually makes it very clear that the purpose of ERM is to increase an organisation's short and long-term value for its stakeholders. The stakeholders being the board and management, the policyholders, the consumers, the regulator, the rating agencies, and the investors. There are a number of forces that have shaped ERM. There are more complicated risks around. Financial products are a lot more sophisticated. We can think of mortgage-backed securities and credit default swaps. Foreign exchange risk is quite common now with globalisation. And, you know, as a last example, climate change is also having an impact on severe weather events. The regulator has had a strong impact on ERM. For instance, APRA's risk management prudential standards in place, and more recently there's been introduction of internal models to determine minimum capital requirements. The rating agencies as well in the last few years have introduced ERM as one of their rating components. There's been a number of advances in risk measurement, such as CAT modelling, VAR and TVAR measures, and economic capital models. There is an opportunistic side to risk. That's been the business of insurers to turn risk into opportunity, but in order to do that, you've got to understand your risk. Most of you would be familiar with that. This is the Standard & Poor's framework for the evaluation of ERM for insurers. It's got five components. The bottom one, the risk management culture, that's really looking at how well is risk management embedded in your organisation, in its daily activities, from the board and top management all the way down to line management and employees. Your risk control processes, They look at, you are identifying, measuring, and mitigating your risk. Your emerging risk management, that's really looking as to whether your organisation is considering risks that have not been identified or are not existent, but that could actually affect your organisation if there was a change in the environment. Your economic capital models, well, they're just considered an important part of a strong ERM framework. And there on top, you've got your strategic risk management, and that's really looking at where your organisation is incorporating risk, risk management, and, you know, return for risk in all of its business and strategic decisions. And then Standard & Poor's, sort of transform all those assessments into one single measure. And interestingly enough, at the end of 07, Standard & Poor's felt that most insurers felt only in the adequate category. So the global financial crisis have prompted a number of development in risk management. One which is quite topical at the moment is around executive remuneration and trying to link it to effective risk management. The International Actuarial Association has also released a paper, I think it was last February, called ID to Strengthen Global Financial Risk Management. And that paper also touches also on executive remuneration. And there's been a number of other reforms as well coming from the G20 and the European Banking Supervisors. Coming back to executive remuneration, APRA is currently working on a principles-based approach to executive remuneration. The purpose of is not to actually focus on remuneration level, but the purpose is to prevent remuneration practice that would encourage inappropriate behaviour taking. There's been a number of other bodies as well. The FSA, the UK regulator, has also issued a draft code of practice, and this one not only focuses on executive remuneration, but on the remuneration across all levels of the company. And there's been also a number of other report issues. The Financial Stability Fund has issued a paper, Principle for Sound Compensation Practices, to apply to all large financial institutions. And that those principles have been endorsed by the G20 leaders in their recent meeting in London. There's been a few fatal risk management flaws identified from the global financial crisis. And the interesting thing about all the flaws that you're looking at there is that, they all in some way contributed to the demise of AIG. So what I'm proposing to do now is just have a closer look at AIG and just try to understand what went wrong there. Well, AIG issued billions of credit default swaps. The exposure was huge. It was around $440 billion. These credit default swaps came with three risks. The first risk is that the underlying securities would default and AIG will have to pay up. The other risk are that the holders of those swaps are entitled to require AIG to post additional collateral should the value of the underlying securities decline or should AIG be downgraded. And also, those swaps have got to be marked to market, so therefore, if they decline in value, AIG has to take write-downs. So if we look at what happened here, towards the mid-07, when the housing slump took a hold, rating agencies started downgrading mortgage securities. So the trading partners of AIG on those swaps started getting nervous, and they started asking AIG to post collaterals. Well, there was a number of demands for collaterals in the 6 months to December 07. In addition to that, in November 07, AIG's auditors reviewed the value of those swaps. And as a result of that, AIG was forced to take their first major write-downs on the swap. Then in February 08, AIG announces large fourth-quarter losses, mainly due from having to reduce the value of their swaps on their books, and again and again, the same thing happened again in May 08, where IAG again had to post major losses for a second time on their first quarter result, again from the reduced value of the swaps on their books. And as a result of that, AIG was subject to a credit downgrade in May 08. That credit downgrade created a bit of a snowball effect, because as a result of the downgrade, AIG was asked to put more collateral up. And because of the downgrade, AIG found it more difficult to actually raise debt in order to finance the collateral. So what happened is that as a result of AIG having difficulties in raising debt, and also because of their large exposures to the swaps, the rating agency then further downgraded AIG in September 08. And that again caused AIG to have to again raise more collateral. And as a result, and they just couldn't do it. So then at this stage, a regulator had to intervene. So the amazing thing about that situation is that the revenue from the swaps was really a very, very small portion of AIG's total revenue. But it actually, caused the company to go down. And one would say, when we all thought that, AIG had a really good, enterprise risk management framework in place. So what happened there? So, let's have a look just a bit at, risk identification. AIG, in their 07 annual report, did actually identify that there were issues with liquidity. In particular, they stated that liquidity could be impaired in the event of a downgrade, and they also mentioned that liquidity could be affected if there was additional requirements for collateral or write-downs. So, it looked like there was some sort of identification at one stage, but obviously it came too late. And if we look at risk measurement, AIG was using sophisticated models to model the risk of default and of AIG having to pay up. However, the models did not consider the risk of future collateral demands, and they did not consider the risk of write-downs. So basically, the two major elements that contributed to AIG's collapse were not modelled. So that sort of suggests to me that AIG did not understand its business enough to be able to supervise the modelling of the swap portfolio. So I suppose, there's a few lessons to learn from this. The first one is that unknown risk can be devastating, and that, small premiums can come with big risks. Understand what's on your balance sheet. And the third one is, you might have a sophisticated model, but is it really doing the job? On those thoughts, I'm going to pass you on to Paul Goswami, who's going to take you through an approach to implement an effective enterprise risk management strategy.
Thanks, Catherine. So what does that actually mean within an enterprise risk management framework? This slide here kind of starts off by actually identifying where are you on the risk enterprise risk management chart. I mean, there's been a lot of work in enterprise risk management aspects in organizations for a long, long time. I think one of the kind of key points that I wanted to bring out for this part of the presentation is the communication throughout the levels of the organization. If you look at the second and third points here about specialist silos and top-down, I think this is kind of typically where a lot of companies find themselves in the sense that actuaries are involved in the DFA side first and foremost, but how that's communicated throughout the organization, and also the concept of a risk appetite is the kind of focus of the next few slides. So at Deloitte, we have developed essentially nine kind of signals as to what involves intelligent framework. I won't go through all those nine aspects now, but certainly if you want to kind of pursue those, there is a white paper that kind of talks about how to implement the stages of an intelligent enterprise risk management framework. But You can see from the diagram that's presented here that it falls into kind of three main levels. You have your risk governance, risk infrastructure management, and risk ownership. I don't know what everyone else in the audience thinks, but certainly I feel that we kind of tend to hover as actuaries between the dark blue and the light blue. And certainly there's some accountability to be able to not only set the risk appetite at a board level, but also make sure that that's communicated throughout the organisation. So what I've seen typically within organisations is that people at the line underwriting level understand their risks very clearly and have a process of how they underwrite. But how that, for example, relates to what the company's risk appetite may be somewhat kind of confusing. I mean, what does it mean for the actual line manager? I mean, how does he deploy his economic model when he's making his underwriting selection? It's these kind of communications that is important when putting together your framework. So we're going to go through a few aspects here as to practically how to implement these stages. I think one of the main focuses will be on risk appetite. There's two or three slides, so we'll kind of go through that a bit later. But essentially, there's a regulatory requirement, and also, again, how that translates down the system is important. People talk about black swans and how do we know what all the risks our company are facing. There are a number of techniques that you can look at as to what are your risks and how do you identify them. We'll go through that too. From a mathematical or a financial perspective, the report and accounts is a fantastic way to kind of generate kind of questions and generate your actual framework. Simply going through line by line on your report and accounts can generate so many issues. And obviously, from a stakeholder point of view, there's many stakeholders to consider. So as to who you're, whose perspective you're looking from is important. And then to conclude, there are a number of techniques that you can look to actually find out, once you've actually put together a risk management framework, what are the gaps and how do you kind of make them, how do you kind of fill those gaps essentially? So talking about risk appetite, I've just stolen some of the information from the Institute of Actuaries and Macquarie Applied Finance School here. And this was a survey that was undertaken in 2008 that had a number of findings, but this one I just wanted to kind of show you and bring to your attention. 76% of firms do not have a fully articulated or clear risk appetite statement. As part of this presentation, we asked some of our students to look at the top five insurance companies in our market and actually find out what their risk attitude and risk statement were. And let's just say that I got a very, very limited amount of feedback. And the feedback that I did get was in some respects like 6 or 7 pages of how people respond to every element of risk in their company. It's quite hard in practice, it seems, to actually have a very succinct risk appetite statement. And having surveyed a few, we'll kind of go on to kind of see what the key aspects of those might be. One thing Ian Loughlin kind of pointed out to me earlier was that you have to take these results with a pinch of salt, because maybe some of the reason that these aren't identified is that there is some, internal issue in terms of how they want to disclose what their risk appetite might be. But I certainly feel that there's a mixture of those two things happening. So to actually develop a risk appetite statement, it's actually a key requirement as part of the risk management strategy that APRA now prescribes. Interestingly enough, one of my colleagues pointed out that there was one line as to what guidance they kind of gave to actually fill in that area of the risk management strategy. So I did a little bit of homework, and I came up with this list, essentially, of things to consider within a risk management framework. Interestingly, which markets do we compete in? Short and longer term strategic objectives are very key to that, because when you're actually kind of tying in your economic model and your risk measures, then you certainly need to have a look at that on a short and long term basis. And also, the kind of piece that I've kind of specialised in and found very interesting is actually the kind of trade-off between these key metrics, i.e., you know, the risk versus return kind of capital trade-off. So it seems to me that when asking the kind of questions to your board, essentially it comes from these four areas. I think capital adequacy is quite well understood. Certainly there is a pre-requirement in Australia to report on that and look at the 1 in 250 from an MER perspective, and also to actually have capital reporting generally. I think the third point is one that hasn't had very much focus. I think relates particularly to the global financial crisis when you look at debt coverage or your ability to meet dividend. But when actually forming a risk appetite, it would be good to actually put your questions in these four buckets. So to actually kind of build the ERM kind of framework, I'm sure most of you have seen this in another guise in your student days or otherwise as the control cycle. Well, putting an ERM framework is no different to that. The risk identification, the risk measurement that we'll talk about a little bit, and then kind of key communication methods to kind of actually see if you're achieving your goals. So I put together this slide in terms of identifying what the key risks of the company are. I think as actuaries, we tend to get involved in the first two columns quite heavily. These are the normal inputs for an economic model. So, you know, you'll be looking at your frequency and severity for your insurance classes. You'll be looking at kind of correlations across insurance classes and also across other types of risk. May that be through an event set with catastrophe modelling, or may that be with curve-fitting solutions with frequency and severity. Similarly, we seem to be becoming more sophisticated on the asset side, but it's interesting that the operational and strategical side is an area that is very hard to quantify. And anecdotally, it seems that when company fails, it seems to be 99.5% of the time, it seems to occur on the operational and strategic element. So I think the kind of main message of this is that this is a way of actually identifying what your risks and where they fall, but it's both quantitative and qualitative. And you can only quantify certain aspects, but your job is not done once you've quantified it. It's just an input into the process to actually work out where you are and how much risk you're taking. When you look at risk measures, I won't go too much into how to build an economic model. I think there's a number of presentations that are heading on that area. But one thing I wanted to kind of bring out here is the reliance of the industry on VAR. VAR is quite well understood, I think, by the audience and by many of the people here. But it has a number of failures. VAR only tells you about the kind of probabilistic aspect of where you are on your loss curve or on your risk appetite. It doesn't tell you about how bad things can get once you hit a certain point. It doesn't tell you any of the information at the long tail part of your distribution. And so the only reason I wanted to kind of highlight these two aspects was that TVAR, I would advocate, is a much better measure, because TVAR, actually in this diagram here, it represents what is the average loss given that you've hit a certain percentile. So given that you've hit the 95 percentile, what's the average of how bad things are going to get? That's a much more meaningful number than, say, your 1 in 250 at an extreme single point. And from a banking perspective, and certainly from an international perspective, it seems that TVAR and XTVAR are really kind of having a lot of favour. And the third one that I put down there is the expected policyholder deficit, which is being used by Standard & Poor's and Best as part of their rating models. And from this perspective, it's just looking at the amount of capital at the 95 percentile and working out what the average is beyond that point. And then once you multiply that by a probability level, you come up with a policy deficit number. So this is how I would advocate to, if you're looking at underwriting losses, for example, then TVAR would be a good measure. If you're looking for profit or loss measures, say I want my company to be in 5% of a certain profit guideline, 95% of the time, then XTVAR would be a much better measure because it looks at the underwriting profit, because it looks at the excess in excess of the mean. So assuming that kind of VAR is well understood by the business community, again, the interesting that the kind of survey reported that, again, it wasn't reported to the kind of board. So actuaries might understand what VAR means and what TVAR means and EPD means, but the board understand it. It seems that we're certainly not communicating that, and maybe some more effort should be put into that area of, again, kind of communication up that pyramid. So a few practical applications just to finish my slides before I hand over to kind of Sean. How do you build a risk management methodology, and how can you identify what the key risks are within your organisation? This is attacked by a frequency and severity type approach, by looking at frequency in certain intervals. Obviously, the actual numbers may change for your company depending on what you think is a big loss or otherwise. But it's a way of identifying and putting not just financial losses, but all types of risk within a framework. If you then combine it with how much control you have on those risks, you can provide a very seamless way to kind of communicate to your board as to what are their key issues. So this diagram here has just got strength of control on your x-axis. And so with low control and a high frequency and severity, then the area circled is obviously like the key most immediate issues that the kind of board needs to consider and has to kind of take on those with some urgency. Again, in the case of AIG, I think the point that Catherine brought out was that if you multiplied the frequency and severity, i.e. what was the maximum loss possible, then it was a huge, huge number. I think that they just assumed that the probability of default just wasn't significant enough. But if they'd gone through an exercise like this, then it may have given them some insights. Another effective way to communicate to the board that I've enjoyed using is this idea of looking at what your current strategy is versus alternative strategies. But before you can actually do that, you have to kind of form what your risk attitude is and what your key metrics are. So for each board, this may be quite different. So it kind of encourages the conversation, which is a good starting point. And so in this example, you've got profit, risk measure, stability, and operational risk as four key things that the risk attitude wants to hit. It's quite a simple approach. I mean, the kind of maths behind this can be quite technical in terms of, you know, how you calculate your risk measure, how you calculate your stability. But essentially, you're scoring these against each of your strategies and comparing your current strategy to alternative strategies. And then again, you speak to the kind of board and you find out what's their most important issue and what do they kind of place more weight on. So the left-hand column is just like a weight of what's more important out of those four objectives when managing your portfolio. And some very simple maths will take you to a weighted score on the bottom. Quite simple approach, but I think very effective. From a diagrammatical point of view, this is one that I like. It's called the radar. It's in PowerPoint, so it's quite easy to use. But again, the objective here is to kind of hit all four nodes. So your best strategy would be hitting all four of these nodes on the outside. So if you have like the perfect diamond, then you've got optimal solution. But invariably with all these things, you can't have maximize your profit and reduce your level of risk. There's always trade-offs. But the thing I like about this communication is that it gives you a comparable way to actually do that. It gives a comparable way to kind of communicate to a board and say, well, you know, you could go for more profit, but it has some impact on your business. And then you can kind of drill down and find out what financial or otherwise those impacts are. Just to kind of wrap up here, I think I'll move on because I think I'm conscious of time. Some good ways to actually identify kind of holes in your risk management framework are to kind of look at things that have gone wrong. Typically, these are some of those examples. But one that I should highlight is the risk appetite. If you haven't got a risk appetite as a starting point, how can you measure anything? Another good way to kind of generate ideas is to look at cause, event, and consequences. again, you know, you couldn't have predicted the World Trade Center, but you could certainly say that as an event, there is, you know, there is terrorism to consider. So in terms of like being out of the box or identifying black swans as they may appear, this is a very good manner to kind of do that. And finally, the kind of gap analysis. Going back to the first slide that I showed you, there's levels of sophistication within organisations that kind of take you from a very average risk management framework to the risk intelligence tier one. And these curly-whirly dotted lines are simply kind of strategies that you can kind of compare and, again, find out where you are. So if you, for example, wanted to look at one of the key metrics, like communication in your organisation, then you could see which one of the tiers you'd actually fall into and how any strategy kind of compares. So, like, you know, the blue and the red lines are basically kind of showing the comparables of those options. So, conscious of time, I'll pass over to Sean to give us a practical overview of some of the clients he's been working with from an operational and strategical point of view. But I would like to add that the opportunity here is for actuaries to merge into new areas. And it's been a pleasure working with Sean from a risk management point of view as well. And I'll pass over to you, Sean, now.
Good afternoon. In the last 10 minutes, I'm going to race through a couple of things. There's three things I really want to get across. One is that strategy and operational risk is often the thing that's not quantitatively measured, and it's often the thing that you really need to worry about. And I'll focus on a couple of examples to reinforce my point. The second thing is that risk appetite doesn't have to be a remote concept. Many organisations, particularly leading banks, are putting risk appetite models and frameworks, and I'll touch on an example of one of those just to illustrate the fact that you can have a documented, process-driven approach to that as well. And lastly, the third point is that most of the clients that I deal with, a small percentage come to you after you've engaged, proposed, discussed or whatever and say, actually, I'm in a role which I don't really understand all of my obligations around risk management. I understand everything about X, Y, Z, but I really don't know how it all hangs together and what are some of the things I should be considering. So, interestingly, maybe the third point first, given the time, is that the greatest learnings that I've seen in clients recently is the need to integrate, particularly organisations who are really sophisticated around the modelling, the work that you guys do. You know, it's highly sophisticated, it's very well developed, and it's in a particular place, and it gives you a false sense of comfort sometimes that because you're so strong in one risk area or in modelling of one aspect of risk that all the other bits are hanging together. And I'm finding that's not always the case. This slide has three real messages, and I've used it a couple of times in recent times, including to a presentation of a board members on, you know, what makes a risk intelligent board. And the three elements I focus on are strategic risk, strategic decision risk, and business risk. And the first one is really, how good is your strategic planning process? I think the GFC has showed us that the assumptions that underpin strategic planning are not necessarily that robust. The goalposts have moved in many cases, but, you know, how is your strategic planning process accommodating the risks that are involved in those assumptions, and how often do you revisit them and retest them? So there's a piece there about that red dotted line. You know, if you have dodgy stuff in your risk planning around your strategy, you can end up with an unrealistic strategic plan. Second point is the infrastructure and management of risk, which allows you to execute your strategic plan. Across your organisation, there are a number of executives who are charged with different objectives, and they have a risk infrastructure and management process to help them achieve that. Often that's seen on the side. Risk, internal audit, compliance. It's that stuff you have to do because someone tells you you have to do it. It just gets in the way of you trying to achieve your numbers. I confess to having been there. I've run a couple of business units in my time, and I used to hate risk. I used to tell them to go away. I used to tell internal audit they were useless. I used to tell consultants they charged too much and just told me my own time. So I'm a bit of a heretic in that respect. But the reality is, if you don't have a good ERM system that integrates that risk infrastructure and that management, not only will you be in strife with the regulators and your stakeholders and shareholders, but you won't get the best bang for buck and you won't come out of this GFC in the best position that you can be in. So that whole piece around that red line deviating away from the blue line is really mitigated by a strong, effective risk management and business management, and to me the two are the same. The third one is the one that people have really not given much emphasis to in the last few years, is how you respond from what happens out there in the real world. You've got your own strategies, you've got your risk frameworks, you've got your people and your skills, and you've got reasonably robust responses to different things that happen in your market. Except when the market goes completely pear-shaped and the things that you didn't dream of happened, how effective is your board, how effective is your senior management and your internal process at actually seeing that quickly for what it is and responding appropriately? So the third one is really about how quickly is your organisation, how agile is it in terms of responding and changing your strategy to make sure that you either take advantage of what's happening or go into a defensive kind of approach. So this slide really talks about the importance of risk management being aligned to strategic thinking, which drives the right kind of strategic execution and being aware of what's going on externally. Sorry about the blue box. You always get caught in PowerPoint when it looks fine on your laptop, but on the screen it just comes out a different colour. Risk appetite engine is what that little blue box says. I guess I won't dwell on this slide given the time, but you can probably get the key messages from yourself. And the emphasis on the next couple of slides is definitely about risk appetite and how that leads through to a management or board dashboard. Now, the board is responsible for signing off on risk appetite. How it's executed is management's responsibility, but it's very hard to approve a risk appetite at a board level unless you actually have all the working parts and knowing how they're connected. So the next two slides really touch on the six key components or pillars, if you like, that I think represent best practice, from what I've seen anyway, in risk appetite development. So every risk appetite needs objectives and principles, and I won't go through all the smaller words. You need a policy, either at group level and you need it broken down. You need methodology and you need metrics. And depending what your business is, these metrics will vary, obviously, but they must be relevant. And I'm presuming you've got this presentation. Yeah. Risk profile, appetite targets, risk type limits, thresholds, a whole bunch of different things. Most important factor is it has to be enterprise-wide. I'm actually working with a client who claims to have an enterprise-wide risk management system that only two-thirds of the organisation are empowered to actually use. So it's interesting that, not only does it have to be enterprise-wide, that means all of the organisation that's accountable, it has to be all risk classes as well. So it has to be as much about HR and people risk and process technology risk as it has to be about financial risk. Governance structures, often a weak point. The whole process and the reporting. The theme of this presentation today is about ERM communication and connectedness. And probably that's one of the things that in the insurance sector I see a little bit of weakness, because the message doesn't always go up and down the tree very clearly, and there's certain not the same kind of understanding at different levels about what people are trying to achieve. And scenario and stress testing. Obviously this is a very mathematical area and I am not an actuary. In fact, I'm a lawyer, but that really... I say that because I know most actuaries hate lawyers. I got told that on the way in. I thought, oh, well, I'll brave it. I'm the last speaker here. But it's relevant for me because it actually, I come at these things from a very, I think, commercial and prudential perspective. I don't understand the way numbers work. I got kicked out of stats when my batteries went flat on my HP. But the importance of stress testing and the importance of actually getting the mathematical substantiation around this section can't be understated. My last slide for today, bringing it all together, is 100 different ways of creating a single slide which shows an ERM footprint. But I think this one is as good as any others. It really emphasises the fact that there's an integration component and there's definitely a risk appetite piece which we've focused a lot on today. Conscious of time, I might just pause there. This is very rare. Any questions? I'd love to have a question, some debate. Thank you, sir. What's your question? Well, there's no wisdom in this answer, but I think what's happening in executive remuneration is an interesting connection, because risk appetite, taking the people away from it, is a mathematical, is a reporting structure connected to a performance management regime, and you suddenly start to connect the way people manage risk and deliver on risk against their objectives, and you can start connecting it through to executive remuneration. And I think one of the things that's been tried in the Basel II world in the banks has been to allocate capital to lower levels in the organisation, make people accountable for the capital that's in their business, and making it link through to performance management. That's the only thing I've seen. It doesn't work very well because it's too remote and too aggregated. And it's a lagging rather than a leading indicator. So I think, you know, if you have, well, I won't go back, but in the two previous slides, in your design of a risk appetite framework, you really need to make sure that there's a connection between accountable executives and the limits, thresholds, tolerances that they can be reported and can be measured against, because that's at present points, other than, you know, normal performance management and the quality of management, which is really what you're ultimately relying on, take that aside, all you've got is some of the measures which you can link through risk appetite. So I don't think there is a clear answer, but I think it comes down to risk appetite framework, and it comes down to quality of management and leadership. Unfortunately. I'm not sure if I answered your question, though. Any other questions?
There is a strong point that, you know, the level of power of the chief risk officer, you know, is a main factor in driving that process. So, you know, there probably needs to be an improvement on that front.
It's a good point that you've raised, in terms of it's not a tick box to say have reviewed. And to have an objective measure of quality is really what you have to strive for, an objective measure of quality, as opposed to, like, quality control, yes or no.
I think there have been plenty of reports released in the last 6 months about the global financial crisis and what went wrong and what should happen, but there was one released by the G30 about a month and a half ago, which is the first that I've read that specifically recommended that the CRO should report, firstly should have one, and then they should report directly to the CEO in a similar independence role that you currently get with audit. And part of the rationale for that was to empower people to actually be held accountable for their risk behaviour. Okay, thank you very much. I'll hand back to Adam, is that right?
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, so there isn't any time for more questions here. I would encourage you to have further conversations with all three of these presenters over lunch. It's easily a topic that could have run to an hour or two rather than 40 minutes or so. So I guess the last thing to do is to thank all three.